So, this year will be different. Really? Really? Will this year be different, or will it be the same thing we did last year? Or will it be different? And if it's going to be different, how? How's it going to be different? What are we going to do to make it a different year than just 2016 or the years that have kind of piled up? How will it be different? Or maybe even the question on why. Why will it be different? What are we going to do about that? Well, it seems to me that what we say is, God, you gave me this life. Here's what all I have really is this life. It's all I have. You know, and you've blessed me with this and blessed me with that, and you haven't blessed me with these other things, right? He's given us all different sets of issues, different circumstances, different blessings, different resources. All of us have different stuff. And you go, how do I take this life and invest it? And then how do we take this? Let's even talk about what we were doing earlier this year. We've asked the question, what does it look like to love? What does it look like to love? What does it smell like to love? What does it do to us if we're going to enter into this idea of really actually loving? What kind of work does that do in our soul and our heart? What kind of transformation? Even on the video, they asked, I'm not really sure I want to be different. I'm not sure I want to do that. God, I maybe I'm really comfortable. And you're going to change me, you're going to have to make me uncomfortable. And I don't know if I really want to go through uncomfortable. Could you just do this instantaneously, please? Could you just create change in me without doing any heart work? Could you not do surgery? Can we just change this without you doing those things? And he says, no, I can't do it that way. I'm going to have to do real work inside of you in order for you to learn what it looks like and what it feels like and what it smells like to love. What if we combine those two for a second here and talk about our love life? Or right now, this in probably a few months, we'll cover or do a series on our love life, about our relationships and about marriage and about sex and about whatever we want to talk about in our love life. But for this month, what I want to talk about is to love life. Okay? Now, here's what I mean by that. On January 15th, typically in the United States, it's officially what we call Sanctity of Life Sunday. And typically what that focuses on is on the unborn. It's been a huge issue in our nation. It's been a divisive issue. It's been a lot of fight over that. I would say there has been great change in recent years. There's been the pro-life movement has really gained a lot of ground, but it's still an issue out there. And so often next week, we would focus on sanctity of life and the unborn. In a lot of churches of America, that'll be the focus next week. But in a lot of churches next week, the focus will be on Martin Luther King, on his birthday being the following day. And the issue is especially for your African-American churches, the civil rights issues are so dear to them and so deep in them that they say, how can you ignore this in our nation today and ignore Martin Luther King and all that he did and all that that represented? How can you ignore that? Which would be typical in a white church, right? And so there seems to be almost this divide within the church. So what we've decided to do, though, is instead of just taking next week to talk about Sanctity of Life Sunday, we're going to make this a Sanctity of Life month, the whole month, okay? We're going to focus on the issues of the sanctity of life and loving life itself. So when we think about the Sanctity of Life month, here's what we're going to do. Is next week, we're going to actually talk about the sanctity of life for the infirm, for the handicapped, for the disabled, for the sick, for the needy. And what does the scriptures have to say about that, which we probably haven't done a very good job of, frankly. And so we're going to talk about that next week. And then the following week, we're going to talk about the sanctity of the life of the elderly, which is a profoundly important one, and one that our nation has even begun to talk about at times of saying, if you're not useful anymore to culture, why don't you go away? Why don't we get rid of you? In years past in Haiti, when you became a drag on society, you were expected to walk into the forest and die by yourself. There are some in our culture who would suggest the exact same thing. Maybe a little bit formed a little differently, but very similar things. So we're going to talk about that. Talk about the importance, the value of the elderly. And then the following week, we are going to talk about the sanctity of the unborn in those issues. For some, that's still uncomfortable. That's hard, and I get it. It's an important issue, but we're going to talk about those things. Sometime, we wanted to talk about the issue, the sanctity of race, and the importance of what God created in us. Well, I don't know if we'll tie it into this or do it separately at another time. But today, what I want to do is talk about the sanctity of all this in a kind of a foundational way, kind of build a platform from which to address all these other things, okay? So, I love this quote. This is a quote by Hubert Humphrey, who was a senator from Minnesota and vice president of the United States. And he made this comment: the moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. We don't quote politicians all that often, and probably Hubert Humphrey hasn't been quoted very often in recent years, but this is an incredible statement, and he's right. It's the moral test of government. And so let's circle it, the moral test of government. We ought to judge ourselves by that and judge our government by that. They're right on a moral level. We ought to. But here's the deal. Our government simply represents you and me. We elected them. And so we really have to ask the question, what's the moral test of our society that we have elected, that we've set in place? We have to look at ourselves in all this thing, as a nation, as a culture. The moral test of that society treating those in the dawn of life, those in the twilight of life, and those in the shadows of life. But maybe more importantly than that, we have to look at the church. We can't keep pointing fingers at government or at culture or society. We have to look at ourselves, the church, and ask ourselves, do we pass or do we fail the moral test of a church as to how we treat those in the dawn of life, those in the twilight of life, and those in the shadows of life? How do we do as a church? What's our commitment to that? Whether it's popular or unpopular, whether it's common or uncommon, how do we deal with that as a people? And I would probably suggest, I don't know if the grade is very high on the way we deal with these issues. And it's probably something we need to look at and wrestle with. Deep down in who we are, what are we doing with all that? So as we kind of then look at this foundation then, what I'd like to do is I'd like to look at a few thoughts from a guy named Jean-Paul Sartre, who is a French existential philosopher of the 20th century. He kind of lived, he died in 1980, but he represents a lot of the thinking, and here's kind of the deal. He wrestled with one of the fundamental questions of philosophy, which is this, which is, why is there something rather than nothing? And that's kind of the fundamental question of all of philosophy. Why is there something rather than nothing? And since there is something, where did it come from? What does it mean? What is its value? What is its meaning? What is it all about? And people have struggled with this in philosophy for years, for centuries, and wrestled with this. And Jean-Paul Sartre wrestled with the same thing. Let me just give you a few of his comments along the way. Look at this. He, in his reflection, said this: man is nothing else but what he makes of himself. Man is nothing else but what he makes of himself. There's no external thing that would define or create man. Man is only what he makes of himself. He's nothing else but that. Whether it be good or bad, right or wrong, up or down, left or right, it's only what man does to himself. Oh, interesting thought. He went on and he said this too. He said, life has no meaning the moment you lose the illusion of eternity. Once you forget that there is no eternity, once you accept, that there is no eternity, then life has no meaning whatsoever. You figure it out. Yes, there's no eternity. We only live for now, and it's kind of a messed up deal, and so it's nothing. Wow, it's incredible. Here's another quote from him. He says, I exist, that is all. And let's finish the quote, and I find it nauseating. That's where he came to in life, in such incredible despair that he couldn't find meaning in himself. It wasn't big enough. It didn't have any meaning to him. And he rejected it, and he says, it's nauseating. Wow. It's interesting, though. He, like every one of us, struggles. Look at this quote. That God does not exist, I cannot deny. That my whole being cries out for God, I cannot forget. You know, though he denied that God existed, he didn't find satisfaction in it. His heart kept asking for God to be in the midst of it. But he felt like he was committing intellectual suicide, or maybe moral suicide, or maybe willful suicide if he believed in God. And here he said, I can never forget it, this ache in my heart for God. Well, it seems to me that when we look for life, when we want to have love life, we have to look a little bit beyond ourselves. And it seems to me that we have to look to the reality that there is a design by God for each one of us, for mankind, for this world, and for everything in it. And it seems to me that it's based in Genesis chapter 1. And part of that I want to look at today is verses 26 through 31. But we find this incredible expression of God creating and designing life itself. And it's interesting, this part I'd like to spend some time in today is really part of day 6 of creation, okay? So, before we go on, let me just say, okay, in day 1 of creation, it says, in the beginning, God created. It doesn't try to defend God. It doesn't try to explain God. It just kind of assumes he is. He has always been, he is, and he will always be. God exists. And in creation, it says in day 1 that he took the darkness and he separated it from the light. And it took him all day to do it. It must have been quite an effort. It's interesting. And at the end of it, he says, the end of day 1, and everything was good. Then, on day 2, he separated the land from the sea. Okay? He separated that which the waters and the seas, and the land was dry land, and he called it good, and there was vegetation. Okay? It was incredible. Now, I'm sorry, that was day 3. On day 2, he separated the light from the dark. I forget what he did on day 2. But it was good, I swear to it. Okay, on day four, he created light. The lights of the sun and the moon and the stars to govern over our lives. Okay? Then on day 5, when he already had the seas going in the land, on day 5, he populated the seas with fish and all the incredible things that are in there. And he populated the skies with all the birds and all the things that live in the skies and the heavens. Oh, I know, day 2, he separated the water from the water. It's a very interesting thought. The waters above from the waters below and the heavens in between. And that's eventually where we're going to get the great flood from, is from the waters above. We'll cover that another day. So, but on day 6, then God populates the earth. Okay? And he populates it with the animals in the first part of the day and all the beautiful things, all those animals on earth. And then the second part of day 6, look at this. It's incredible. Verse 26. Then God said, now here's the deal. All God had to do was say it. He created with his word. He just had to speak it into being. It's incredible. It says, then God said, let us, the plurality of God, the Trinity of God, they let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Now, he's going to make man, but he's not going to make man. We're not like God in that we are omnipresent or omnipowerful. We're not like him in that way, but we are like him in his character. He gave us the ability to love, to think, and to create, to design, to engage. That's what God is like. And so he gave us that ability. He's creating us in his image. And it says, and let them have domain over the fishes of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock, the things that he created on days 5 and 6, right? He's saying, have total dominion over that. They are going to be the caretakers of all of that. And over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, they'll have dominion over that. Wow, it's incredible. He makes us different. You know, in chapter 2, it's going to be a little bit more telescopic. He's going to get in closer. And he's going to say that he wanted to create mankind, and he takes the dust of the earth and he pulls it together. Just like he did with the animals, as we see in that chapter. From the elements of the earth, he pulls them together and he makes all of creation. But to mankind, what he does, it says that he forms it and he breathes life into its nostrils. He breathes a soul into man, like nothing else in all creation. Now, we live in a culture that wants to kind of make us and the animals equal. Here's the reality. They're not. They were not given a soul by the breath of God. Only you and I were. Wow, that's an incredible thought. And then he says, I'm going to give you dominion over all those things. Wow. He's going to give us responsibility for all of those things. Verse 27, and so God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Seems redundant, right? He just says it twice. But that's kind of sometimes the way the Hebrew writers and the way God even re-emphasizes things. So God created us in his image. Is that an amazing thought? That you carry in some unique and beautiful way the image of God. And if you do, then the person sitting next to you does. And the person who's going to wait at you at the restaurant does today. And the person who works down at the local business does. I was really touched this past couple of weeks when we went down on Christmas Day to the nursing home. And we sang carols. The Walkers started this years ago. And so we just kept doing it. And there was a lady there working with the elderly and the disabled. And I just said, hey, thank you for what you do. And she just turned like to me and kind of like, well, you're an idiot. You know, you're kind of dumb. She said, I love this. I love doing this. And I just went, oh, my gosh, you love this. This is hard for me to be here. You know, this is not comfortable. And she's like, yeah, I get it. I love this. And I was so blown away. And that what God had created in her was much like what God is like. Maybe God would be saying, I love being here. I love these people. Wow. So God created man in his image, in the image of God he created him. And then I find this unique. Male and female, he created them. In the uniqueness of God's creating us in his image, in the unity of that, he made difference. The uniqueness of a man and a woman, a male and a female. Wow. We live in a culture that's undermining that, that seems to demean that, want to blur the lines of that, change that, reject that. And I wonder if in rejecting that, we reject then the very beauty of being made in the image of God. That there is this uniqueness about being a woman. And it ought to be celebrated. It ought to be admired, appreciated, held up. Wow. Wow. A woman. We have demeaned being a man. The uniqueness of God's creation of being a man. All you have to do is watch TV and it just makes fun of men. We don't make fun of women in our culture. We simply use them. But we make fun of men. Something's wrong here. We demean the creation of God when we do that. What an awesome thing to be a guy. It's cool. What an amazing thing to be a woman. It's cool. It's neat. Wow. We ought to be going, that's incredible. And to celebrate that God made us both uniquely human and uniquely male and uniquely female. And when we forget that, demean that, reject that, we reject something fundamentally important. Now, we live in a time, the whole transgender issue is a big deal. There are statistics which show that that numbers of people struggle with transgender feelings. But most psychologists will say that that is an incredibly normal thing to do in the growing up years, trying to figure out, well, what does it mean to be a guy? What does it mean to be a boy? You know, this feels a little weird. I'm trying to figure out what it means to develop as a guy. Same thing with gals. It's a very normal developmental process. But when we enter in and say, well, maybe you're not, that we actually do violence to their psychological health. We do violence to them. In fact, studies show that probably 70 to 80% of all people who struggle deeply with transgender issues will, with time, have grown through it and find themselves very settled with who they are and who God made them. But if we say, no, 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 golly, you know what? Maybe we need to help you struggle through this. And in fact, affirm your struggle. We need to affirm the difficulty of it, but we need to also say, you know, you'll find what it means that God made you a guy. It comes into being. I experienced that growing up, wondering, will I ever really be a man? And if I'm not, where does that leave me if I don't? That's really a natural developmental process. And there's this really incredible thing that you say, man, he made me a guy. It's beautiful. It's awesome. Wow, he made this person called a woman. What an amazing, beautiful thing. And now, is every guy G.I. Joe? Is every guy Jack Bauer? Is every guy, John Wayne? You know what? That is not the model of what it means to be a guy. It's much bigger than that. The box of what God made as a man is much bigger than that. There are some guys who are very creative, very artistic, very musical. They don't really love shooting things. Doesn't mean they're not a guy. Are you kidding me? That's nutty. Not every gal is Barbie. Not every gal wants to hang out in Victoria's Secret all the time on TV. Some of them are much more solid than that. But it doesn't mean they're not a woman. That's crazy thinking. We demean that. The uniqueness of what it means to be a woman, wow. Or what it means to be a guy, wow. So God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created them male and female. He created them. Wow. That doesn't mean that everybody's supposed to be married. No. Does it mean that you have to have 15 kids? No. It means just enjoying who God created you. Wow, that's an incredible thing. When we stop celebrating that, we lose the beauty of life. The beauty of what life's all about. Okay? Well, let's go to verse 28. And it says, and God blessed them. Wow, that's incredible. God blessed them. And God said to them, hey, you guys, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. That's incredible. He says, subdue it. You know what the Hebrew word for subdue? We'll cover this in a few minutes too, but it's kibosh. And now in our culture, it means to put a kibosh on something. It means to take a hammer and kind of whack it, right? I'm going to put a kibosh. You know, if your kids, all of a sudden you find out your teenage kid has a plan, and it's not a good plan, you know, and you're like, okay, I'm going to put a kibosh on this one. It's not really actually. The word means much more to give direction to and form to and organize it and deal with it and manage it well. It's very soft. And before the fall, there was no evil in the world. And so Adam and Eve were given responsibility to put a kibosh, if you will, on all of creation. And it means to simply nurture it. Nurture it. Bring it along. Have dominion. Be responsible. Do well with this. Wow. Have dominion. Raha. Rada is what that means in Hebrew. And it's this idea of giving it direction. Giving it form. Wow. And over all of these things. And then it says that God said, behold, I have given every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. Evidently, in the original creation, we were vegetarians. He gave them that for food. He didn't give the animals to them for food. Wow, look at this in verse 30. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. He kind of reemphasizes it. And so it was. Verse 31. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. First time that he says it's very good. It's like finally on day six, he stands back and he looks at all of creation of all the days, but especially this last part of day six, and he says, not only is it good, but it's very good. It's like this incredible comment. And he steps back and he goes, yeah, that's cool. Now, the angelic world already existed. And I can almost imagine in that angelic world as they watch him and doing all these things that they're going, wow, that's amazing. Look at what he just did. Look at the light he created. Look at the sun, the stars, the moon. Look at the vegetation. Look at the land. Look at the sea. Like they're going, wow, this is amazing. It's like being in a movie and just going, that's awesome. And then on day six, at the end of the day when he made God in his image, I think a hush went over heaven, a gasp. His image. Finally, God's image. It's like his signet ring on top of this. His authorship of life itself, of people that God created. It was very good. It says, and then there was evening and then morning the sixth day. Wow. So I just have a few things I want to drive home here. Five things I'd like to drive home in a significant way. First of all is this. Being made in the image of God. Imago Dei. That's maybe one kind of grabbing onto. It's Latin. It's kind of a fun word. Imago Dei. You can just say that, you know, and it's kind of fun. Imago Dei. It means the image of God. You and I were made in the image of God. It is what defines us as people. When we reject that definition, we find ourselves in very shaky ground. We find ourselves creating life for ourselves. And to the end of that, we create chaos. We create a mess. And we begin to hurt ourselves and other people when we reject what God has for us. Now, does that mean it's easy to figure it all out? No. We live in a really broken world. But Imago Dei defines us, right? Francis Schaeffer put it this way in his book, He is There and He is Not Silent. He says this, there is something great about mankind, and we have lost perhaps our greatest opportunity of evangelism in this generation by not insisting that it is the Bible that explains why man is great, why man is profoundly valuable, why man is uniquely different from everything else in the world today. We have lost our greatest opportunity for evangelism. Of being able to say, you have profound value because you are simply human. And God made you that way. Wow. And to treat people like that. Wow. Imago Dei, we're made in the image of God. It defines who we are. Secondly, us. If it defines us, then us is expressed uniquely in male and female. And to celebrate that, Peter Kreft, who's a professor of philosophy at Boston College, said it this way one time. He said, the two most ridiculous errors about men and women are unisexism and male chauvinism. This is a great comment, you guys. The unisex feminist says that women and men are not different in value. That's true. Therefore, they are not different in nature. That's not true. The male chauvinist says men and women are different in nature. That's true. And therefore, they are different in value. That is not true. We are uniquely the same and uniquely different. No one better than the other. Both necessary, correct, obviously. Wow. And we ought not to get caught up in the ridiculousness of this sexism fight. God created us male and female, and we ought to celebrate it, lift it up, value it. Now, I don't know about you guys, if you're married, I don't know if you sometimes have a hard time figuring out this person you're married to, right? Maybe you don't. Maybe you got it. Sometimes it seems like chemistry to me, and I flunked chemistry. Like, man, how does this work? I don't get it. She's really different than me. She thinks differently. She feels differently. Do you know that every molecule in her body is different than mine? Every molecule. Wow. She's different than me. And sometimes I think she looks at me and she thinks I am from outer space. That I am like totally weird. I'm so different than her. And yet God made it that way. For us to learn to deal with each other, but also enjoy and appreciate. Give room for the other person to be uniquely different and fit together. Wow. I think we need to know that us is expressed uniquely in male and female. Third is he tells us to multiply. I think he's telling us, yes, to multiply physically, of course. That's part of the deal. But not in for every person in every way, but to really thrive, to share our lives and invest our lives in the future. As a single person, you can do that too. And we ought to value that as people, right? Sometimes singles feel like a second-class citizen in churches, and they ought not to. It's wrong. I mean, because of who they are, investing themselves in the life of a community is so powerful and so meaningful. Fourth, to subdue. We already talked about the Hebrew word kabash and to exercise responsibility from the Hebrew word radah. That's what we're supposed to do. But just think about it. That was Genesis 1 and 2, right? And then the fall happened in Genesis 3, and everything got screwed up. Sin ruined everything. It marred everything. It broke everything. Not just some things. It marred everything. It messed it all up. But God didn't quit on it, but he did make some changes along the way. Look at this in Genesis chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. It says, "And God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them," this is after the flood. Okay, so he floods the world, and he just keeps Noah and his family, and he says to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Sound familiar? It's exactly what happened in Genesis 1 and 2. He says, "The fear of you and the dread of you shall come upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered." That is not true in Genesis 1 and 2. There seemed to be they figured it out. It wasn't a problem. When they saw a tiger in the jungle, Genesis 1 and 2, they did not gasp. They did not go, "Oh my goodness." My sister was training for a marathon, and she lived in the mountains outside of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and she was back in this one place about 7 miles running, and she came up over this rise, and standing right on the path in front of her was a mountain lion. And she knew she ought not to keep going. And she stopped, and she began to back up just slowly, very slowly. And then that cat began to circle her. And then you shouldn't panic. So my sister turned and ran like crazy. And that cat didn't catch her. It didn't come after her. But she knew there's a problem between me and the mountain lion. There is animosity, right? It wasn't there in Genesis 1 and 2. It is today. It is today. And he says, there's a fear and a dread that goes on between here. Look at verse 3. "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you." Every living thing. It's changed. All of a sudden it's changed. "And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life," that is its blood. Make sure you cook it, is what he's saying. "And for your lifeblood," look at this, "for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning." A reckoning is a judgment of whether it's good or bad and how to rectify that. And he says, "In your lifeblood, there be a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man." Look at it. He's saying this. If you now can kill animals to eat, you have to make it fair. You have to rectify it. You have to do it well. Don't be abusive. Use it, do it well. You have to rectify this. You have to make it right. Yes, you can now eat them. And I'm glad. I like a steak. You know, I enjoy a good steak. But just to kill, is evil. Even animals. Diane went to Uganda before we were married. She spent a summer in Uganda. And when Idi Amin was leaving the country as a dictator, he told his army to indiscriminately kill all the wildlife. Just destroy them. It was evil what he did. Wow. But he says there's a reckoning. I mean, look at this very last sentence. "From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man." He says you are responsible for each other, and you have no right to deal evilly with one another. There is a reckoning. Yes, you have to manage conflict. In the world now, Genesis 3 on, right? There's huge conflict. We see it all over the place, right? We see this incredible disaster between people. And we just name it, right? Fort Lauderdale a few days ago. Jerusalem yesterday. You just keep going. Aleppo is one of the biggest human disasters in years in our world. You have no right to deal indiscriminately and evilly with people. You have no right. You have to reckon this. You have to do it right. Yes, is there a place to deal with people who violate what is right? Yes, but you have to reckon it. You have to do it well. That's your responsibility, people. I don't know about you, but that's not an easy responsibility that we've been given to deal. We were made for non-brokenness, and we live in an incredibly broken world, and we are given that responsibility. Wow. Number five, mankind identified as very good. Wow. Even in our brokenness, God values his image in you and in me. You see, mankind, men and women, are a broken glory. They are a broken, we are a broken glory. And God is about his redemptive work, but he made us. You see, he has given us the incredible privilege of being made in his image. He has given us this unique way to express it as a male and a female. He has given us this incredible responsibility to multiply and to thrive and to invest. He has given us the responsibility of subduing, having dominion, and dealing with this incredibly broken world, and to do it well. Do it with justice. Do it fairly. And he calls us still his love. He calls us the ones that he adores, the ones he wants to work in. Is that amazing? And so it's really not going to matter whether we're the infirm or the elderly, the unborn, or whoever it might be. God gives us value, and that's where it comes from. So we don't have to say it's nauseating, and we don't have to agree with Sartre when he says there is no God, because there actually is a God, and that's why his heart wanted God, because there actually is a God, and he can embrace him. Wow, it's an incredible thought. So we'll go from here, because God gives us value. Every one of you, because he knows you by name, every hair on your head, whether there's a lot or a little. He knows everything about you, and he still loves you. It's an incredible thing. And he's breathed into us life, a soul. That'll make living worthwhile, even when it's broken, right? Let's pray. Father, there is an emptiness in this world. There is an emptiness in our own hearts when we fill our lives without you being the central figure. When we try to fill it with all of the stuff of life, it's not enough. It doesn't fit. When we try to fill it with ourselves, it is totally inadequate. When we try to figure out life without you, Sartre said it was nauseating to him. And we get that. And we also understand that there is something going on in his heart, as there is in ours, that aches for the presence of God, of you. And Father, incredible that you decided to reveal yourself so clearly in your Son. And that not only did he come to reveal what you're like, but he came to pay the price for the sin in our own lives where we ran away from you. We denied you. We tried to live life without you. And to that end, we did huge damage to ourselves and to others. And at the end of the day, we violated you deeply. Deep down in who we are, we violated you. But instead of running away or just kind of throwing us away, you sent your Son. You sent your Son to build a bridge, to give us an opportunity to know you. And not a bridge that we walk over, but it's one you walked over. You came to us. For you so loved the world that you gave your only Son, that whoever might believe would never perish, but have eternal life. And so for that, we are so grateful. for making us who we are. May we celebrate it. And may we celebrate those around us for the unique people you made them. Help us to do that well this week. And we pray these things in the matchless name of Jesus. Amen.